Good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome to our ninth session of functional needs presentations. My name is Karen Seidman. I work with the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. And welcome to Ashtabula, Ashland, and Medina County. So the goal, as it has been all along, is to plan and operate emergency shelters and points of dispensing in Northeast Ohio responsive to the needs of all community members. The presentation tonight will be by Deanna Dahlgrove, who is a physician with University Hospital, and I will let her introduce herself, and she also has the objectives as part of her presentation, so that's why you're not getting them from me. So, Dr. Dahlgrove.
Good evening, everyone. Can you all hear me in the back? People on the phone can hear, hopefully. Karen called me a few months ago and said really needed something on children and children in shelters, and so I thought I would sort of address some of those needs. So I'm going to address it from the standpoint of these are kids that either arrive at a shelter or you sort of run into and sort of talking about things like that. How many people have a fair amount of experience with children other than just being a parent? Okay, so you guys can all pipe up if you have expert commentary and things like that for sure, because I'm a peds emergency medicine physician at Rainbow. I'm the chair of the disaster committee, and I'm also on the steering committee for the state of Ohio's pediatric disaster coalition. In addition to, I chair a committee at the American Academy of Pediatrics on disaster preparedness for peds emergency medicine physicians. So we're just going to kind of go over kind of more the mental health aspects of taking care of kids and not so much the physiologic aspects and physical things that happen for them. So I attended the IOM conference in June that looked at preparedness for children and families across the nation. It was actually a very well-run conference, and I got a lot of great material from that conference, and there's some good resources that I've been able to include in this presentation for you guys. So the first thing is, the objectives for this are just to differentiate factors that contribute to coping psychologically in disasters. You can apply these to children, you can apply them to adults, you can apply them to people that have mental health disorders and things like that, so all those kinds of things. And then we're going to sort of concentrate on just understanding normal developmental stages for children and their normal reactions, as well as the impact that disasters potentially can have on them. And then understand means of coping with children in disasters to promote, hopefully, what we would anticipate be a positive recovery for them. And then to identify some of the resources that communities might want to look at for assisting with, trying to plan a little bit better for how to take care of children. So the first thing is the reason we want to help children and why it's so important is because we are preparing and coping with disasters will assist them in the long term to help them prevent emotional trauma to them in their future life. So when they go through an incident and you're a five-year-old as opposed to somebody that's 55 years old, you've got probably another 80 years of your life or so, at least 70 years of your life that you're going to expand on. And if that tragic incident happens really early in your life and you don't have a positive recovery from it, you have more chances of having behavioral disorders and psychological disorders as you go on, in addition to things like antisocial behavior and PTSD. So some of the things that they looked at when they looked at Katrina and they started reviewing what happened was that they found that these were some of the factors that really affected the mental health of people after Katrina. So any families that had parental mental health distress or mental health illness in the parent was a contributing factor to kids' recovery. There was lots of informal support and social structures that seemed to sometimes be there and sometimes not. So those were a little bit inconsistent. So there was this minimal sense of community. So the community didn't feel like it was there. It just sort of dispersed. It was all gone. There was a lot of unstable housing, and there was definitely loss of household income for a lot of families. There was food insecurity, in addition to poor family functioning that started sort of all the things that sort of contributed to the overall mental health problems that they anticipated for Katrina. So some of the things that can influence really good psychological well-being, just in general, are things like the type and the intensity of the exposure. So, you know, one bad thunderstorm, you know, with the trees that fall down in your yard and things like that, you know, might not be so bad for a family, but, you know, something that consistently goes on for days and days and days, there's no electricity, there's no food, you know, there's no access, things like that, might increase the intensity of the whole process. Availability of family support is also important, kind of before, during, and after the event, I would say. And then the other thing that kids are really receptive to, especially when they're really young, is the disruption of just sort of daily routines. You know, so if you wake up and you brush your teeth and you get dressed and you go to eat breakfast and you go to school in the morning, that's what kids do every day. And when that doesn't happen, they sort of get out of their routine and they really find it hard to kind of get back into it. And I noticed this just with, like, toddlers, you know. So, you know, parents go away on a trip, you know, and grandma's babysitting for a few days. You know, they just don't sleep as well, they didn't eat as well, things, you know, behavior just sort of changes, and that's just in a normal day-to-day function. And then the amount of social chaos that goes on in a situation can also impact how psychological well-being is going to influence all the recovery. So resilience and vulnerability are two big words that people look at now when you're talking about you know, sort of good functioning and things like that. So when you start looking at resilience, these are some of the factors that, you know, people look at and sort of pull out. You have good cognitive ability. So in kids, that's variable because, you know, little kids, you know, don't think the same way as adults do. They're not real logical and things like that. They have a positive self-construct, which includes self-efficacy. You know, so they have a meaning in their life. They have self-control. And that doesn't describe all children on a day-to-day basis anyway, but these are just important things that are going to be there as they start to grow up. Their attitudes and their beliefs and how they're incorporated, whether they're hopeful, whether they have a faith or belief system that they look at, and positive worldviews. So these can just be applied to adults or older people in addition. And then the ability to sort of sustain relationships with others is going to be really important. So those are just some big kind of overall concepts that are really important to helping people sort of get through these disaster-type situations. The other thing are factors that contribute to the vulnerability. So you can imagine age and development are a big factor. So, you know, littler kids are going to definitely be more affected by the chaotic environment than potentially older kids. But I wouldn't just say that's just sort of a general statement. And you have dependency on caregivers. So if you're a small child and you're separated from your caregiver, whether it be your parents or your guardian, those are going to have a really big impact on those kids at that point. So the kids that are unaccompanied or they get separated from their families in those situations really makes them much more emotionally vulnerable at that point. In males, we find that there's a lot of externalizing behaviors in males. They can tend to be a little bit more aggressive, and in general, females can internalize emotions a little bit more. And those, are generalizations, and I wouldn't, you know, apply those to everybody. And then there's anybody that's had any previous physical or mental health is going to be more at risk for being vulnerable to the disaster-type situation. And then families and communities that are sort of functioning sort of on the brink of sort of disaster or day-to-day anyways are going to definitely have more problems than other families. So if you have, you know, families that are sort of, you know, have food insecurity on a day-to-day basis and then a disaster strikes and they can't even get, they can't get their breakfast at school, they can't get their lunch at school, they have no access. So, you know, those are just, you know, those are families that are just on a day-to-day basis just trying to make ends meet. So some of the things, these are some of the initial stages of response that you might see when, and this goes across many age groups, and we're just going to sort of talk about some general concepts first, and then we'll sort of break it down into individual age groups. So fear and denial, confusion, daze, numbness. And the other thing that's important to remember is that, you know, so if you have a really mature teenager that on a day-to-day basis seems like they can go to their job every day, they go to school, they get their homework done, and everything seems to manage, you know, a disaster situation hits, that person can actually regress. And as adults, we can do that too. You know, you just sort of, you just can't cope with all the things that are around you, and so you either shut things out and you become really quiet and things like that. So those can be reactions that you can see. In addition to, you can see people getting very angry and very frustrated and yelling and things like that. But, you know, they can be sort of across the board. So you just sort of have to be ready for all the different kinds of reactions. I'd say that as things sort of progress, you know, if you're in a disaster situation that's going on for more days and weeks and months and things like that, you may start to see other responses like much more regressive behavior that just continues to go on. You know, they sort of have a lot of anguish and there's just fear, there's sadness. This is when depression will start to set in. There can be a lot of hostility as well as this sort of apathy about the whole thing. And the thing that we sort of get upset about is when you start to notice that these people, that these symptoms just keep going. They don't seem to be able to come out of it. They don't seem to be able to smile. They don't seem to be able to engage. And so when these things keep going, this is when you start to identify that maybe there's going to be some more problems. So if you're starting, if you're in a place where you're actually working with these people and you sort of have interacted with the same person day after day after day, you start noticing that, you know, things just really aren't changing. They're really getting a lot worse. These are the kind of behaviors we want to start watching for. And we're going to go into a little bit more detail. So PTSD is the thing that I think we want to try and prevent by having a more positive recovery, sort of getting kids back into a normal environment as fast as possible. And this is just one definition that I found, that it arises after a delayed or protracted response to a stressful event with exceptionally threatening nature, which is likely to cause a pervasive distress in almost anyone. So really, you know, it's a situation where everybody would potentially be very distressed about the whole situation, but what actually ends up happening is their response actually just becomes much more protracted, and they just don't seem to be able to come out of it like other people seem to be doing. So things that are going to contribute to that are just previous exposure to traumatic events can be very, can have a huge impact on contributing to this PTSD. The other thing that you'll notice about them is they keep re-experiencing the event. You know, so if it was one big event that happened, whether it was, you know, a huge storm or it was a, you know, terrorist attack, if it was one of these shooting events that has happened recently, the person just keeps re-experiencing this event. And so that's kind of the thing that can sort of trigger that you might want to be thinking about PTSD from the mental health professionals. They avoid stimuli that are associated with trauma or the symptoms and things like that. And then sometimes they have symptoms of just increased arousal, so they just don't sleep well, they just can't get to sleep, they can't stay awake to sleep for a long time. And a lot of these symptoms seem to go on for greater than a month or so, and that's when mental health professionals start to look for referring them. So these are some of the contributors to children when you look for PTSD. So any child that's separated either from their parent or caregiver, they're going to have a lot of fear about, you know, did their parent die? What happened to them? Are they really ill? What's going on with them? If the child had a great deal of physical injury, or maybe they just had a lot of pain related to that injury, and that is something that can contribute to the PTSD. You know, any time that you have their caregivers are with them, but their caregivers are so distracted by the whole situation that they can't provide support for the children, that's going to be really important for them. They're just going to have a hard time actually helping the kids at that point because the parent or the guardian is just so unable to actually meet the needs of the child at that point. And then the mask, I don't know if you've heard that, you know, one of the things that we try and avoid with kids is you try and avoid having those television strings of things just playing in the background or radio, or they just keep talking about the events. You want to take the mass media stuff out of their preview so that they can't see a lot of that, because that actually contributes to recreating, reliving the event over and over and over. And then the other thing that ends up, and this is where the community really becomes important, is when you have a community that has a sort of fragmented response, you know, you just don't have any kind of coordination, that's going to really be important to contributing how kids get back together. So I have some examples kind of later on about notes from the Joplin tornado that was actually really helpful. The woman that was the head of the school board actually came and talked to us at the IOM conference in June. It was really very interesting listening. It just actually brought tears to your eyes to see how this community actually came together and supported both the families and the children in order to make a positive recovery for them. So we're just going to go over some things like depression and things that sort of things, just general terms to sort of look for that you can see. So people aren't sleeping well often can be a sign of depression. They're not eating a lot, or they're eating too much. They're overeating. They just sort of feel hopeless or helpless. They're frustrated. They have emotional outbursts. Those are things that you can see. In addition to they're just don't, you know, little kids may not want to play. They may just want to sit in the corner by themselves. And you know, the regression behavior that you can see probably in a little bit of a school age to an adolescent might be things that you might want to look at. And then the other thing that's at the bottom that got kind of cut off is their school performance starts to fail. So getting kids back into school is one of those things that, you know, we try and do quickly after some kind of a disaster occurs, because that's kind of their normal environment that provides a normal kind of day for them, because that's what most children are doing. So anxiety is another thing that they can have. They can have fear of the dark, which is a pretty common one that we see. They have irritability. They can be very restless, recurrent thoughts, feelings, things like that. And then concentration and memory problems, which will show up in a school environment, or things like that, as well as some somatic complaints. They can have just rocking movements, shaking. They can have chest pain. They can say their tummy hurts, things like that. And those can be just sort of signs that, you know, they don't really have any symptoms of vomiting or diarrhea, but nothing's just hurt all the time. So those are just some of the things to keep an eye out for. And then we'll talk about, these are sort of the big clues of where, this is where we can really help. So getting back to the normal routine is probably the most helpful. And you have to sort of think about, what is the normal routine for a toddler? What's the normal routine for a school-aged child? And what's the normal routine for an adolescent? So, you know, that's meals and sleeping. It could be school, if it's available. For littler kids, it's probably going to be opportunities to play, you know, draw, interact with, you know, kids their own age is really going to be important. For probably older school-aged children and adolescents, it's just a chance for them to sit around in groups with peers and just sort of talk, and it's a normal behavior for them. And then the other thing that's really important is to support the caregivers. You know, I mentioned in a previous slide that you have caregivers that may be very distracted by the whole situation, too, and not able to cope with their own situation, is to really to sort of encourage the caregivers to just sort of, you know, support them by being patient and listening to them. And sort of helping them find ways to kind of cope in a healthy way that may actually be able to help them take care of their children, because their children at that point really need them also. Listening is just a really good thing to do. But the other thing that's important is just setting sort of normal limits and expectations, not letting them get away with, you know, eating all of the, you know, cookies that are in the kitchen because that seems like a good idea. But just sort of normal limits on play and things like that would be really helpful. And then kids really do a good job of coping. We're really surprised. You know, we have kids that have some remarkable illnesses and things like that we take care of. They have injuries that they come in that I've seen in the emergency department. And, you know, sometimes it's the child that's actually more together than the parent. And it's really interesting knowing that kind of dynamic and how that switched and stuff like that. And so kids really are able to cope very well. But it's important to sort of realize, too, that, you know, they might be kind of showing themselves to be very strong in that situation because they've read their parent now, and their parent's really stressed out, and they don't want to contribute to their parent's stress, so they're just going to act more grown up and do things like that. So that's another kind of behavior that you have to sort of watch out for, that, you know, you think, wow, they're really taking on a lot of responsibility. They're acting really grown up. And, you know, that in a situation is it's probably really important to listen to that child. And, you know, they may be coping just fine, but they also might be doing it as a reaction because their caregiver is feeling so uncomfortable at that point. These are some communication tips that we sort of get from our child life specialists that work in the emergency department with kids and things like that. And just in general, so when you're talking with kids, you just want to use clear, simple language. You don't want to get too complicated. You want to answer their questions directly. You don't want to give too many details. You don't want to say, well, I think this might be happening or that might be happening. You just sort of want to just give the, you know, real straightforward answer at that point as much as you can. And if you don't have the answer, it's probably okay to say, I don't have the answer. But it's going to be really important to answer their question directly. And as I talk, you know, when I talk with my my kids, I usually talk with them and answer their questions until they don't ask questions anymore. And when they stop asking questions, that's usually the sign that they've had enough information and now it's time to go away. So I don't need to keep telling them more information and things like that. You want to acknowledge their emotions as much as possible. It's sometimes really challenging because sometimes you feel very emotionally distraught about what has happened or the story, or you might have information. And so it can be really challenging to hide your own emotions, but if you're able to, it can really at least let the child at that point express their emotions and things like that. But sometimes you just can't, and so that's okay. Trying to be super strong and not have tears rolling down out of your eyes, it's just, you know, sometimes you just have to do that, especially if it's a situation that you found just making you distraught too. It's okay to let them know that. And then the other, probably the most important thing is, you know, some of the kids will express suicidal and homicidal kind of thoughts or statements. And in those kinds of situations, it's really important to identify them to a mental health professional at that point so that we can get them more assistance. So these are for anybody that, when I learned this stuff when I was going through my developmental behavioral elective when I was a pediatric resident. These are the classic stages of development, if anybody ever wants to get back into them, so it's Piaget and Erickson. And they go through the different stages of, you know, how kids approach things and stuff like that. So I pretty much just put this up for those people that are really into, like, stages of development and things like that, and how they kind of get along. But, you know, when you sort of look at these things, I think the thing that sort of, you know, when you're an infant and things like that, you know, do you trust people? You sort of want to get some independence and things like that. As you start to get into the toddler stage, you know, you think about that. You know, you see the toddler that wants to, you know, run off and do something, and then they turn around and they're looking back at their parent to check and make sure it's okay. So, you know, think about some of those normal developmental things that sort of go on and the way kids think. But we're going to go into more details now, just sort of what normal behaviors look like and sort of go past the theories and stuff. So I grouped them into infants and toddlers together, preschoolers and school-age kids and adolescents, so that it keep it a little bit simple. So these are just sort of normal behaviors. So if you're in an environment where you're, you know, sort of assisting with taking care of kids and stuff like that, for those of you that don't remember, you know, babies and things along those lines, it's really normal for kids to wake up at night at 4 months of age. 9 months old all have stranger anxiety. You know, those are the ones that, you know, they look at you and they're like this, you know, and so it takes a little bit of time for them to warm up to you. It's pretty common for kids that are a year old to have some aggression and some biting behavior, to be hitting and things like that. That's normal. By the time they're 18 months, they're usually not hitting as much anymore, so now you can start setting limits and sort of guiding things. But then they also have their tantrums and things like that. And then sometime around 24 months, and it can be a little bit later. I just put these up as generalizations. There's some toilet training. So that's kind of just sort of the sort of behavior spectrum that you might see. And this is just, these are just real generalizations, just to sort of get you thinking, you know, how different the 0 to 2-year-old can actually be over time. So in this age group, the things that are really important for them, they need to eat, they need to sleep, they need to have lots of cuddling time, caring people around them. And as they start to get a little bit older, they definitely need stimulation. They want to play and interact. So those are kind of the most important things. Their needs are pretty straightforward, you know, pretty simple at this point. And that's, you know, really, you know, the things that are going to be important for them to have reestablished. So then you get into preschoolers. And so preschoolers, you know, they start to have more, you know, they start to play more house. They sometimes in the early preschool age groups, like the 2 to 3-year-olds, they sort of play side by side. You know, you'll have one person playing with the truck, the other person be playing with the car, and then all the other kid will look over and say, I really want to play with that truck, and you'll have them fight and try and get it away from each other, but that happens. And then by the time they're 4 and 5, they start to have more interactive play. So this is when you typically think of kids playing house, or, you know, maybe they're playing, you know, that they're running a gas station or something along those lines. It might be a high-tech industry at this point. There's a lot of stubborn behavior, especially in the 2 to 3-year-old age groups, even 4-year-olds. I think all of us remember that my sister's going through that 3-year-old stage. Do they ever get through this? I'm like, yeah, between 3 and 4 is probably the worst, and then they're teenagers. And then, you know, they get into compliant behavior as they start to get a little bit older, and this can be a really sweet age too. You know, so they can have this, you know, they can have this really stubborn behavior, and then 15 minutes later they can come around and ask if they can help set the table or something. So, you know, that's the other thing. And they have a lot of magical thinking. They have a lot of imagination that they'll play and things like that. And those are really important things that these are just normal behaviors that you can actually sort of tap into in addition when you're sort of thinking about these kids. So preschoolers, again, they need food, they need sleep. They may actually have some kind of a toy or something that they may need to go to sleep with, whether it's a blanket or something along those lines. Play can be just drawing, you know, reading books, playing with other children, things like that. You know, you want to answer their questions truthfully. You want to acknowledge their feelings at this age. And again, this magical thinking is important to remember, you know, that they may take a story and they might embellish it quite a bit. So remember that those kinds of things can happen, and that's just normal. You know, it's when it starts to get a little bit wild and they start to add things to it, they get a little bit, like in this picture a little bit, where Teddy is floating down the street, and I cried a lot, Teddy was scared, and other things were floating away too. So that's, you know, just an example of what a child might have drawn or thought about or put into words. I don't think a three-year-old drew that picture, but it gives you an idea. So in school age, this is called the latency age, if you go back to Piaget's theory. They seek a lot of acceptance from others beyond their parents. So they look to teachers, they look to other adults. You know, they're really into sort of making people happy. They're working on their self-esteem, and they are sort of just looking at, you know, trying to figure out how do others, where do I fit in, how do I work, you know, and that sort of moves into adolescence too. They're really into being very fair. You know, everything has to be fair at this age. You know, that guy can't have more than I had as far as, you know, three cookies or four cookies, things like that. And they're very concrete. They like rules. So the rules, they will tell you what the rules are. They'll want to fix the rules, and they don't like the rules to be broken. So in this age, it's really important to acknowledge the feelings and listen to them. You know, it's really going to be important to sort of, you know, if there's a situation that went on, you want to reassure them that it's not necessarily their fault, especially if it wasn't their fault. In this one, you want to really not have a lot of media exposure. You really want to, you know, make sure that the radio, TV, and those kinds of situations are off. Maybe even access to computers. They're definitely going to need to socialize with other children. And one of the things that's really great with this age group, they're really helpful and very capable of, you know, helping with cleaning, gathering food, things like that. So you can use them as workhorses. You know, this is a good age group to do that. They really want to do that. They're going to follow directions. They're probably going to work well in groups and things like that. And distraction is probably, by having them do jobs, is probably a really good way of having them participate and sort of giving them something important to do and giving them a role. So then there's the teenagers. And teenagers really can be across the board. They could be like school-aged children. Hopefully they won't be like toddlers, but you know, they can really, you know, they can also be very much like adults, and they can be coping very well. So I just sort of picked some general ideas. You know, they definitely have more abstract thought, and they can see that there's consequences for behavior and things like that when they start to think about things. They may not always apply great decision-making, as we well know, so that's something to kind of think about. But they will be thinking about future implications for the process of what's happened. They're going to be really concerned about fitting in. If everybody remembers back to your teenage years, where did you fit, which group did you run with, things like that. That's going to be really important. There might be, in the older adolescents, there might be a lot of idealism going on. You know, they might have some really strong ideas about what needs to happen. And they're going to be in this, have a lot of conflict between, you know, sort of wanting to have a lot of autonomy versus, you know, sort of, you know, helping out and things like that. The other thing to be important, realize, is that there's emergent sexuality in this age group, and it varies across the age. It could start as a 10-year-old, it could be a 12-year-old, it could be a 17-year-old. So, you know, in shelter environments and things like that, it's something that's really important to sort of recognize that those things are going to be there. There's going to be lots of peer influences are going to be really important, and separation from the family. They're going to want some separation from their family at different times, but they're also going to want to be together. So that kind of goes with this conflict between, you know, sort of being independent and having a lot of autonomy to wanting to have, you know, the connectedness of the family environment in addition. So in adolescence, it's probably important to recognize that their behavior can be anywhere from adult-like to child-like across the board. Just hopefully you can meet them where they're at. I think that's probably the most important thing. You probably want to listen in on the peer group discussions that happen every now and then. Let them participate in peer groups. They can have some acting out behavior. They may have some substance abuse or sexual acting out, things like that. The revenge thoughts are the ones that you kind of want to listen to and find out how much they're thinking about acting on them. These are the ones where you can have, if there's truly revenge thoughts that have some homicidal components to them, that you want to identify that they probably need a little bit more help than just talking to a lay professional. They probably need a mental health professional at that point. And then other things, they're really able, you can start to use distraction for them too, but you also can use guided imagery and things like that and sort of get them to sort of, you know, get their mind to go to a different place and things like that is some other techniques that might work. So this is a table that I pulled from the American Academy of Pediatrics Children and Disasters website has a whole bunch of resources, and this is one of the resources that goes over outside of sort of normal reactions for kids and stuff like that. And it's probably hard to read in the back, but basically there's three columns. They go by age group, and then there's reactions in the first 72 hours, reactions in the first month, and then reactions in the second and third month. So if we take the three-year-olds, you're going to see that they could be have a lot of fear to any kind of like stimuli, loud noises, things like that that might sort of rehash the whole event for them, things like that. They might not be able to get to sleep really well, things like that. And then later on, you might see they might have an appetite loss. They might still have continued sleep disorders. They might not be able to talk really well, things like that. And then reactions during the third month can be just having problems at school, not eating or eating a lot, and the other thing that can be concerning is sort of just repetitive play that keeps taking them back into the traumatic event as they get further and further out. And those would be more signs of PTSD and things like that. And then there's the other age groups kind of go through what the reactions potentially could be that would be sort of concerning with an emergency or disaster situation. And then this is another table that talks about recommendations for both parents as well as teachers. So when you start getting them, when you start seeing sleeping disorders or you start seeing excessive clinging, incontinence of urine, things like that, regressive behaviors, it's important to sort of identify these kinds of behaviors and, with the sleep disorders, they're talking about reassurance, sort of using normal bedtimes, normal waking times. Those are going to be really important. As much as possible, leaving potentially a nightlight on might help, things like that. And then it's kind of hard for teachers. Teachers would probably notice this in a situation of a child being really sleepy in the classroom, and it would probably be important for them to identify it with the parents at that point and sort of talk what's going on if they're getting able to go back to the school situation. They also talk about, with some of the clingy behavior, allowing the parents to come back into the classroom, sort of working with them as a family and stuff like that, if the parent's able to be, kind of do that in that situation. And then these are just further recommendations for other things like further that the table goes through school problems, it goes through anxiety, it goes through aggression, rebellion, all sorts of things. But I think these are this whole thing on the AAP's American Academy's website is actually just really helpful. And if you really want good resources, it's their chapter on psychological care and disasters, and it's just a really good resource to kind of go through and really get into the nuts and bolts and the details of, how do I look at kids, what kinds of things will I do. And then this is just the final table from that one that's talking about some of the pain and somatic complaints as well as bereavement. Letting kids be sad is okay. Listening to them is going to be really important. And one of the things that's probably really important is acknowledging it in class. There was another resource that I left that's on the last slide that Dr. Schoenfeld did, and he's got a whole video, and it's on the National Public Health and Disasters in Medicine's website, and he's got a whole psychological module that he's actually put together. And part of the module was actually some kids talking about when their parents had actually passed away. And one of the things that they talked about was that, in the classroom, nobody wanted to acknowledge it. Nobody wanted to let them talk about it. And they said that was just really tough because they really did want to talk about it. They wanted to, they needed to, but, nobody wanted to mention it. They just sort of wanted to brush it under the rug. So it's really a very powerful video to watch these kids sort of reflecting, it's really hard for them not to, everybody's sort of pretending, sort of walking around in eggshells. They don't want to mention anything. But, for the kids, it's important for them to know, if their teachers acknowledge that, yeah, we know something happened. Do you want to talk about it? Do you want to reflect on it? So those are some of the things, especially if kids lose a parent or a guardian or somebody that's, really close in their family in a disaster, it's probably really important to acknowledge that and not to, just sort of let it, go by the wayside after a little bit of time. So these are the things that are probably really important is when to refer. So I think I already mentioned suicidal and homicidal thoughts. Those are the ones, you know, so if you get into a situation a child is starting to reflect on this and, you know, they say they just want to go away, they want to disappear, you know, they want somebody else to go away or disappear, those are probably things that you probably want them to talk to a mental health professional at that point. And the symptoms that, you know, start to interfere with everyday life, and you start to notice that those tummy aches are there every single day at the same time, they don't go away, things like that, and it's going on for a whole month, that becomes much more concerning. If they're threatening others, obviously, and their behavior starts to interfere with just their being able to get dressed in the morning, brush their teeth, things like that. Those are just the activities of daily living that they're supposed to do as well as their school environment. If they're too withdrawn for too long, that becomes really concerning. Nightmares that sort of persist for a really long period of time as well as just explosive behavior. And then in the adolescence, it's the substance abuse and things like that that are really important to identify and get some help. So this is where you sort of start to think about, you know, your community and what kinds of things you can do. And I think you guys are already doing it by just sort of getting an awareness of, you know, what are the things that I might need to think about by even participating tonight. So, you know, just education on behavioral and emotional needs by age is really important. And this is just really a general overview. It's really hard to sort of, you know, give you everything that you would need. But having an awareness of that and reading other resources will really be helpful. Among any community members, you know, your school teachers are actually a great resource. Daycare providers are a great resource. They really understand normal behavior and development in kids and things like that, and then working with them to sort of help them educate, you know, whether it be first responders and other people in the community that might be important, as well as yourself to sort of say, you know, we really need you to help us understand what to do for kids and help us in the planning. Planning for programs in schools that will start to look for emotional problems when kids would go back to sort of normal, you know, daycare and school environments is probably really important for those school teachers as well as daycare providers to have some knowledge of what the, you know, sort of abnormal behaviors are and what things are going on. And then the other thing that's really important for all of us is to help families really plan to understand in these situations, you know, are they really prepared for disaster? What are they going to do? You know, what are their, you know, what are their family support structure like, you know, whether it's in the community or whether it's, you know, two states away. Those are really important things that will help families feel a little bit more secure about the whole thing. And these are the lessons from Joplin that I pulled from this woman's presentation. So Joplin was a pretty small community. You remember the tornado hit May 22nd of 2 years ago. So they describe themselves as a really tight community. I forget how many, I don't know what the population of their area was, but it's pretty isolated down there in the southwestern corner of Missouri. And the school seemed to have relationships with everybody. Schools were a really important integral part of the whole entire community. And so the thing was, when those tornadoes hit, literally the school board decided, they got together, they got the teachers together, principals and the schools and things like that, and they set a clear goal that they were going to start school in the fall at the normal time. And they were just going to go right ahead and see what they needed to do. And the teachers and the principals got together in teams, and they actually went out and they found the families. They found them wherever they were at, whether they moved to temporary shelters and things like that. And they made contact with them within just a couple of weeks of the whole incident happening, despite the fact that these teachers and principals had had disasters happen in their own families. They got together as a school community and went out and did this. And they decided to run summer schools. So they had these kind of temporary villages that got set up, and they had community rec centers, and they ran summer school for the kids. So they were able to get the kids back into a daily routine because a lot of kids didn't have their homes, so they didn't have a daily routine. Their neighborhoods had been drawn apart, and they didn't know if their friend, you know, Billy was okay and things like that. So by having the teachers interconnected with the principals as well as the kids, they were actually able to sort of get back into a daily routine, and they felt that this was a really powerful thing. So what they did is they also described their they had to go back to school in the fall, and they said they had temporary facilities, but they didn't have temporary education. So they said, you know, education is going forward and only in temporary facilities, so it's important that you know that education is important. This is your job, and you know, we take it pretty seriously. And the other thing that they did is they really took care of the adults. They didn't just check in with the kids, they checked in with the whole family. And so when I look at a community and I, you know, just you just sat there and you just I just had tears running down my eyes when I was listening to this. It was very powerful listening to how this community was so resilient at getting themselves back together. And the other thing that they decided to do is they had a lot of frequent celebrations. So they celebrated the first day of school. They celebrated, like, the second week of school. It was really interesting, and they said that that was really important, you know, just to have celebrations to have celebrations. It really became important for bringing people together and making them feel good. So just to sort of go back and review what some of the protectors and the promoters of positive recovery are going to be. So for kids as well as adults or anybody, it's going to be having sort of a positive self-identity is going to be really important. Having some executive control as well as self-regulation, which, you know, in younger kids, they just don't have. Coping skills are really important, so this is just an important part that will add to resilience for that, as well as supportive relationships. So these are really important factors that help. So the other thing is having people help others is really helpful, you know, letting people, you know, use their skills and encouraging people to help. So whether it's the elementary school kids going in and helping, you know, sweep the floor or, you know, set up tables and get dishes, things like that is really helpful. Clean tables, that can be really important. Sort of just having a positive view of the whole entire world. In addition, stability at home and in your community also really helps people move forward. This is another resource that I would recommend people start looking at. It's called Psych Start, and it's a resource that's put together by this gentleman, Dr. Shriver. He's out of Oklahoma City, and so he started looking at how do we integrate, you know, children's mental health into communities, and what do we do? And so he does. He sort of started recommending. He's got some tools that we can use to look at, you know, sort of community gap analysis, you know, looking at, you know, what are the resources we have in our community? Do we have a lot of schools? Do we have a lot of daycares? You know, what are our resources? How do we use those teachers? How do we use those daycare providers? Things like that. How do we use our first responders, you know, in those kinds of situations? The general concept is to listen and to protect and then connect. And that's sort of the overall concept that he likes to use in this Site Start tool. And then he creates this Children's Response and Coordination Group, which is part of the operations section in HICS, and helps sort of respond to what children's needs are. So once you've identified your resources in your community, you're able to start plugging them into this operations section. And this is, the next slide is actually a detailed map of sort of how it looks. For those of us, I'm involved in EMSC. And how EMSC kind of works, he's actually working with our he's working with us nationally on disaster preparedness, at sort of looking at how do we take care of people that take care of others. So responders, he's actually looking at us as doing that too. So there's the schools and community health, and it's sort of integrating at every level, you know, sort of really looking at, you know, what are our resources in the community to take care of kids' mental health. Cuyahoga County's fairly good at that. We're getting better. I know we definitely have holes across the county that I know about, but it's kind of identifying, you know, kids. There's a whole tool that we can use to kind of identify, you know, which kids are going to have more high risk, low risk, as well as moderate risk when we start integrating them. And then the other thing that's really important for kids, as I think you'll remember I mentioned, is, you know, if they're separated from their caregiver, that's going to be a really big red flag for them. So that's a really important thing to figure out. You know, I think many of you remember from Katrina that, you know, it took 6 months or so for the last kid to be reunified with their family members. Maybe it was even longer than that. But I think family reunification is something that I don't know that we know how to do really well. And there's definitely people working on it. There's different patient connection kinds of things, whether we're using our electronic health records or things like that. The other thing is the Red Cross has put together this website called Safe and Well. It's an online registry, and it's a two-way registry. So you can register if you're a family member looking for somebody, and you can register if you're a victim at a shelter or something like that. And that's one thing to do. There's some international tracing technology that can be used. The Armed Forces has some emergency services and communication techniques that they can use. Other things that have been used are Facebook and Twitter, signing up on those. whatever the latest Instagram site is or something like that. And then there's Google Missing Persons, which has been used before also. So those are really important techniques to use. This is the American Red Cross was at the IOM conference, and this is their Safe and Well website. It's a picture that I took from their presentation, and it's a way that you can actually kind of go in and register and things like that in big disaster situations. And then there's another thing that's actually being used. This is really interesting. This is being piloted in Chicago right now. So this is a hospital website that allows victims that are coming to the hospital to register them with the American Red Cross. And they're doing this in the Chicago area right now when they're running disaster drills. So it's another interesting resource that's not ready to go live across the nation yet, but at least it's being tested and might show up at some point. That didn't turn out so well. So the other organization that I thought was really helpful is Save the Children, which some of you may have heard about. And so Save the Children comes in, and they are sort of on scene actually fairly quickly to help run child care centers, and they'll show up and take care of kids. And so they have immediate response and recovery, and they really work well with the community. You know, when they go in and they sort of say, the community says, you know, this is where we need a child care center, this organization can come in and run the child care center. They've got people that are vetted and that know how to do this. They bring toys, they bring formula, they bring diapers, and all sorts of things that can kind of help do this if, you know, the community needs it. And they work sort of to build, you know, sort of to help make sure that the children are going to have a place that, you know, they can feel safe and comfortable in this kind of situation. And they work really closely with the community providers. So now I'll take some questions, and then I'm going to actually turn it over to the last slide if you guys want to write down some of the resources that I wrote down. The ones that I think are probably the most helpful, this is the second one is there, is the National Center for Disaster Medicine and Public Health. It's actually this one right here. It's really helpful. And then the top one is the AAP's Children and Disasters website, which has a bunch of resources that I would recommend that you go to. Those are probably some of my best resources to actually go to, in addition to the CDC, which I think has some good stuff on the health and medical stuff in addition. So I'll take questions.
Let's start with Medina County. Medina, do you have any questions?
There was a conference that she mentioned that she attended. One of the attendees was asking what that was. Again, please.
It's the Institute of Medicine's conference. It was in June 2013. You can probably pull up the proceedings by Googling it.
Thank you, Doctor. Anything else? I don't think we have any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't remember if Ashland or Ashtabula was going next, but how about Ashland? Do you have any questions, Ray, down there?
To contact Save the Children.
I would just go to their website. Just Google Save the Children.
Do you have any other questions?
No, we're okay.
Okay. How about Ashtabula?
We don't have any questions right now, Karen. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Okay, so we'll open it up for Cuyahoga County.
Yep. Save the Children, is that part of the Red Cross?
No, it's actually, I actually think it's a faith-based organization, but they're pretty, gave a very impressive presentation at the IOM conference, and I think very well respected. They responded to Oklahoma, they responded to Joplin. They literally have volunteers that are like, pack it up and go with their stuff, and they're there, like within 24 hours. It's amazing.
Do you feel it's a good thing to teach kids in school about disaster?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely there's some programming that goes on in different school systems, but you know, there's definitely not. I think there's Red Cross has one program, I think. But it's definitely something we could do better with. You know, taking it home and having them teach their families about it is really helpful. I always struggle with the urban environment because, you know, I take care of a lot of kids that, you know, sort of live, I would consider their families and the kids live on the edge, you know, and so, you know, for them to go home and, you know, talk about disaster planning, really, you know, they're not going to have 3 days worth of water and 3 days worth of food, you know, because they're getting breakfast at school. So You know, I think, you know, to some degree, you know, you have to think about the environment that you're teaching to.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.